We have two panel discussions today before we leave each other at noon. The central question that this first of two panel discussions is meant to address is what should or could a federal guidance document say to encourage placement and mitigation where we have the greatest benefit and probability for long-term sustainability in a district with extensive watershed planning. And the second panel discussion we'll have today will deal with the same issue, but in districts with very little watershed planning and capacity. So this is, a real central issue of this whole 2.5 day workshop is really getting your feedback on for the MAP work group on what you feel this should be contained in this guidance. And we felt that it would be a really great opportunity, the symposium, to have a bunch of field people give us their perspective. And the way that we felt that it would be effective to do that was instead of having them speak and draw from only their experiences and constrained by the story they have to tell from their own experiences working with decision support tools or watershed planning or not, we constructed a scenario for them to respond to so that we could remove them from the specifics of what they issues that they're dealing with in their districts and their regions, and they could generalize a little bit more broadly. Again, the first panel discussion is about how what federal guidance should or could say about placing mitigation in a district with extensive watershed planning already in place. We have a copy of the scenario that they're going to be working with up here. We have a 30 minute presentation followed by a 35 minute facilitated discussion. And our two speakers this morning are Steve Eggers, Jeffrey Mangler, and Steve Morris. Steve Eggers is a senior ecologist and certified professional wetland scientist with the St. Paul District of the Army Corps of Engineers. He has 25 years of experience working with the Forest Regulatory Program. Jeff Mangler has worked as a biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Chicago Field Office for the last 11 years. The majority of his time, he was responsible for nearly all 404, Section 10, NEPA, and other federal project reviews for the 6-county Chicago region. And Steve Morris has been with NOAA Fisheries since 1984 and has served as a senior policy analyst since 1999. His duties include coordination with regional executives on the implementation of the Northwest Forest Plan, with emphasis on implementation of the aquatic conservation strategy. Turn it over to the three of you.
We're supposed to go up there?
Yeah, I think the best we got is there.
We were told that by the beginning of day three, you guys would be sick of PowerPoints. But we're doing one anyway. Okay, if you haven't read our scenario, and I don't suppose you've had the time, it specifically deals with the speckled salmon. I know a lot about salmon. I've never heard of the speckled salmon, but I'm sure that there is one. If there's one, then it's endangered. If there's more, then it has a chance. I've been involved several times with the development of recovery plans for salmon, and it's really difficult. I think that there are recovery plans out there for other species. With salmon, it's different because they're highly migratory. They swim upriver, they swim back down. And it's difficult to coordinate and organize everybody just to figure out what you need to get them recovered. There's an HCP in place. This is how non-federal entities get authorization for incidental take through an incidental take permit, the application of which includes a habitat conservation plan. Over the course of the past 10 years, the Speckled Salmon National Estuary Program has developed a CCMP with the involvement of federal, state, and local agencies, citizen and environmental organizations, and the regulated community, which means that all the pieces are in place for the completion of a recovery plan. You've got all of the important stakeholders involved, and it looks like you have what you need. The NEP has an executive committee on which the Corps, FWS, and NOAA all have a seat. In addition to other players, it's good that you roped NOAA into that because now you've got us co-opted into the development of this. The program has conducted. Yeah, I'm sorry. This is the first time I've seen this. The program has conducted a landscape assessment of how what a landscape assessment of how the watershed works in terms of its function and structural elements, a historical assessment of what aquatic resources have been lost in the watershed, an assessment of remaining aquatic resources, including an inventory of wetlands, and they have analyzed priorities and restoration options. In looking over some of the material for this, some of the earlier iterations of the logical steps included a final logical step, which involves determining where and how much habitat needs to be restored for whatever goal you're trying to attain. In the case of salmon, that really is the big question for us. We, in a lot of cases, have all this information except for that final step. We really don't know enough about the species and its habitat and the relationships between species and habitat and the various economies at play for us to actually complete the recovery plan. And so that is kind of where we are. That's kind of where you are with the scenario. The question to us was, how do we get people to do things within our district and within the RR estuary that will be consistent with the NEP? And there are various mechanisms, I think, that we've discussed and we'll be looking at that will get that done. So I'm going to turn over to Steve, who's going to talk a little bit more.
We'll have a fully developed watershed plan, complete with historical loss trends and mitigation priorities all laid out before you. That is kind of a fantasy for, in my experience, unfortunately, I've only had one project in regulatory where we had maybe half of this kind of information. And as we've all seen the last 2 days, having a map that shows the most critical resource areas overlaid with the proposed development, whether it be a highway or a subdivision, greatly facilitates decision making. So we all know that. And our task here is, how do we take this wonderful information, actually implement it, put it on the ground and where it would do the most good? So I'm going to talk about the Clean Water Act perspective. That's what I work with. And then Steve will get back up and talk more with Endangered Species Act, and then Jeff will be the closer. So that's our plan. So specific to the Corps' regulatory program, how could we give guidance to our staff on how to implement this wealth of information? Well, definitely the Corps' regulatory program can be a powerful tool in implementing such a plan, whether it be kind of a general watershed plan, or in this case we have a specific comprehensive conservation management plan. Very powerful tool. It can be both the stick approach and the carrot approach, and I'll show you each. So first, the Corps always likes to publish public notices as part of our requirement. Let's get the word out. Let's educate the public, notify that here's a plan, here's the goals and objectives, and make sure the regulated public is aware. We've done our fair duty to notify the public, and especially, say, the mitigation providers and the consulting firms that we work with. First and foremost, we always avoid and minimize impacts to aquatic resources, but here we have an actual plan, and let's target maximum avoidance and minimization for those areas that are identified as critical in the plan. So that's just those first two items, B and C, are just standard operating approach for the Corps' regulatory program. But here we actually have a lot more data, a lot more background, a lot more things to back up our decisions. So how about some of those carrots, the incentives to achieve concurrence with our plan? We can look at authorizing regional general permits for activities that are in conformance with the watershed approach and the CCMP. Very good carrot, expedited permit processing. Also, we can expedite compensatory mitigation, site selection, and design. For example, mitigation bankers, we're always dealing with bankers and proposed bank sites. And here we can actually lay down a plan in front of them. Well, here's some good areas for a potential bank site. These are critical areas for preservation under our plan. If you want to go over here in an area that's not a priority and establish a bank site, well, you know, you're not getting expedited approval for that bank site. It still might be good mitigation credits, but it's not really what we're looking for. So we have the ability to advise and direct bank sponsors, or it could be the third party for in-lieu fee as well. How about the disincentives, the stick approach? Now, the Corps doesn't like this approach as well, but we do deny permits, we do modify permits, we have the ability to do special condition permits. So again, a powerful tool. So if we have projects proposed in areas that are not within, say, the area proposed for or suitable for development, or it's getting into adjacent or even into the critical habitat areas, number one, it's going to be an individual permit. And number two, if the permit's issued, you're going to be hit with special conditions to minimize or avoid impacts to those resources. And number three, of course, we have the option to deny permits. So again, a powerful tool. And with regard to compensatory mitigation, we could consider rejecting mitigation that's outside the high priority areas for restoration, enhancement, preservation. Or let's say it still is going to create some good quality wetland credits, but it's not really what the targeted mitigation objectives are, so we give reduced credit. So again, that's an incentive to conform to the plan and accomplish mitigation in the identified areas for high priority. And how about those lawyers? We talked a little bit yesterday. As soon as we start drawing lines on a map and putting symbols and involving private property, the lawyers show up. And it just seems to be as we progress, more and more lawyers show up more frequently. So how do we address the legal challenge? Well, we're going to involve the stakeholders. We're going to public notice. We're going to develop general permits. We're going to make decisions consistent with the plan. And what this all demonstrates is that the agency is not being arbitrary and capricious. You can stand up to that in court. And as we talked about yesterday, courts will generally give deference to an agency if their actions are not arbitrary and capricious. That's all I had. Yes? That was part of our scenario. And again, it was a comprehensive conservation management plan. And I think Steve, with all his experience with salmon, he would be better qualified to answer.
In other words, it's not a core function, the CCMP. No, right. No. Is it a estuary? Is it a national?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Under what program? National estuary program.
Well, in Tampa Bay, an estuary program there has developed the CCMP.
Yeah, we have one too in San Francisco, but.
I didn't let the Corps play.
We might have played, but there's no general permit or anything. It's not connected with permitting. Let me put it that way.
Right.
I don't know, maybe
Mobile Bay CCMP. That I've read that extensively. I don't, and I guess that would be my question. Who would, and maybe it's not as up to date as the Tampa Bay, but my question would be like, who would actually do the interpretation of making those decisions of what would be consistent within that? Because ours is a very broad-based in general. Would it be the Corps? Would it be through this public process?
The Corps would prepare, whether it's an individual permit or general permit, we have to prepare a NEPA document. So in our environmental assessment, or EIS, we would pull that in as one of our factors we consider in our permit decision. So it's not an official Corps plan, but we bring that into our decision-making process, and it would probably carry a lot of weight.
What would you do with nationwide permits? You said that anything that wasn't consistent with the CCMP, would those become individuals?
I knew that's a good point. For small projects, still nationwide permits and other general permits could apply. The Corps would have the ability to override nationwide permits if appropriate. That's not used very frequently, but we do have that authority. So if we
permit for things that were consistent with that watershed plan.
Right. So you can also special.
regional conditional.
Okay. So again, the CORE's regulatory program is a powerful tool to assist in implementing this.
Yeah, there's sort of an assumption here that we have one plan and this general consensus out there. There are probably going to be competing plans for different objectives, different species, different interests. And I would think the CORE wouldn't want to be in the middle of endorsing one over the other. And so how would you deal with that? Would you force them to all come to the table and agree? And then
agree with the Corps of Engineers?
No, I mean agree with the agree with each other. Otherwise, you're favoring a particular plan, then you're in the middle of a real mess.
Because usually when you bring all your stakeholders together to do watershed planning, Corps regulatory isn't at the table. They're too busy. They have permits to process.
Right.
But somebody mentioned yesterday about the mutual trust. If the agencies didn't develop a plan, we don't like it. But if the stakeholders didn't have input in the plan, they don't like it. So maybe the answer is we need to find a way to have regulators involved in that stakeholder process so when you get there, it is a plan everybody's on board with. But also in our scenario, it's kind of the additional fantasy part was that not only did it have a recovery plan, it had a habitat conservation plan for the listed species,
yeah.
And then it had the CCMP through the estuary program, and so it had all these layers of plans already in place, and then the real fantasy was it had all this GIS data to go with it that was internally consistent.
Can I clarify one thing about the whole scenario? The details are not important. Just put forth are in a scenario where you have a district that's got all these information available, all the research has gone into it, all the data layers, all the background assessments, they have all this incredible amount of information. That's one. The second component of the scenario that is relevant is that there's a relationship that's in place. Because of the National Estuary Program, these agencies are already sitting down at the table, they already have a working relationship. Then this national guidance is going to be kind of superimposed over that. How do they take what they already have, is already working, and build from that rather than, they could be put in a position where all that needs to be thrown out the door and they need to start from scratch. So that's kind of what the scenario meant to set up, is a lot of information and already a working relationship. In that kind of a context, what could or should the federal government say? I think we should let the guy speak first, maybe, and then.
I just had one comment to the question about if the Corps wasn't involved in the CCMP or if there's a CCMP and an HCP that don't agree. It seems like the process of developing the regional general permit would be a way, even if you had two competing watershed-based plans, the process of developing the general permit would bring the Corps to the table, would bring those, and it wouldn't be a matter of saying, okay, we've got two plans, let's make them one. It would just be, we're going to develop a regulatory mechanism, and let's make sure it incorporates the appropriate parts of both plans. And it seems like that would actually work.
Right. I agree. Yeah.
Okay, just, I'm back again. If all this stuff doesn't work, there is one other option, and that's to bring in the National Marine Fisheries Service. right. Hold us in abeyance till we're really needed. Section 9 of the ESA prohibits the unauthorized take of a listed species, and in this case, you can't kill any speckled salmon. The authorization of incidental take under the ESA can occur a couple of different ways. If we're dealing with a federal action, which is any action that is brought forward by, aided, funded, abetted, or otherwise encouraged by a federal agency, then the action is likely to or may affect, that's a technical term, may affect a listed species, then that agency must come to us and deal with it one way or the other. If the action is not likely to adversely affect, that's another technical term, then all we have to do is agree with that agency and we can write a letter of concurrence through the informal consultation process and that action can go forward regardless of what it is. If the action is likely to adversely affect, then by statute, a formal consultation is required, and in that the result of that formal consultation is a biological opinion, which includes an incidental take statement and terms and conditions, and that incidental take statement would allow that project to go forward pursuant to and consistent with the terms and conditions. A non-federal entity must apply for incidental take through Section 10 of the ESA, and included in their application is a proposal to manage their habitat. That's called an HCP or a habitat conservation plan. If we agree with them and we think that their management of their habitat is consistent with the recovery of the listed species, then we will authorize and grant a permit, and we can include terms and conditions in that permit. Therefore, actions that are consistent with the terms and conditions can go forward. So those are two ways that the National Marine Fisheries Service or the Fish and Wildlife Service authorizes incidental take. We can condition actions, we can condition projects and proposals that way through the terms and conditions. Another way that we can incorporate plans, broad landscape level plans, or even project specific or project type specific plans, is through a programmatic consultation. We do this quite regularly, as often as we can. We try and encourage federal action agencies to bundle their stuff together, so to speak, come forward with a series of like projects that have similar characteristics, or a program. For instance, we work with the Corps of Engineers on out west. For some reason, riprap is very popular. So we try and encourage them to provide us with terms and conditions, best management practices, whatever you want, and in a program that we can do a consultation on. And this way we can encourage riprap to be placed in certain places and under certain conditions. The same thing with dolphins and pilings, any type of work in water, and a compensatory mitigation banks would fall under that category as well. So what we can do then with these three different tools is encourage or impose, prescribe certain conditions on projects. We can make the recalcitrant applicants be consistent with the NEP, with the CCNP, whatever, provided that we have approved it, and we have to do a consultation ourselves on the plan if we want to be able to include the terms and conditions of that plan. The fourth way is through the involvement in the recovery plan. The recovery plan is supposed to be something that kind of sews everything together. It tells you what you need. It tells you where you need it. It involves all of the players and the stakeholders. And it should cover everything within the range of the species you're talking about. In this case, it would be the speckled salmon that species needs for recovery. And when we first list a species, the local entities generally react in two different ways. They either want to get on board, and we've seen this in Oregon where we've listed a number of different salmon species, and watershed councils have suddenly formed and decided that they want to be involved in the development of the recovery plan. The other way they can go is they can resist and become defiant and say, no, this is a federal issue, keep us out of it. But eventually everybody comes around and they begin to realize the value of cooperation and coordination in involvement and development of the recovery plan. And this is another way that we can make sure that things are happening consistent with the requirements of recovery for the species, and in this case, consistent with the requirements of the NEP and the CCNP. So that's what I got to say.
Okay, I guess somehow I got the task of tying this all together, and I was hoping I would have great inspiration as I listened to them talk and you ask questions, and that didn't happen.
We're not very inspired.
So I had some points that I had thought of before I came here, of things, because one of our tasks, they've kind of gone over some of the tools that we think could be used to sort of make this thing we were asked to do is what kind of feedback do we give back to Washington on how to craft this guidance. And obviously, I think we're all going to say it needs the flexibility to work in those situations where we have lots of data, like in this scenario, or in situations where we have some but less data, maybe a watershed plan. And in those situations where we have none, of course, we all know the problem with flexibility is then consultants and applicants see those as giant loopholes and do stuff we don't want with that flexibility. But a few things. You know, we've talked about the fact that citing compensatory mitigation could be done in ways here that will achieve the best long-term sustainability. So we're going to need a little more flexibility in being able to do that. If the watershed plans say that we need more wetlands here and these are the ones that should be preserved, you know, we mentioned earlier the avoidance and minimize. Well, right now, that's just kind of a blanket. You have to avoid and minimize first, right, under the 404B1 guidelines. In a way, we need the flexibility to say you need to avoid and minimize when it's consistent with this watershed plan, whatever the document is that's in place in that district. And a lot of times those have said these kinds of wetlands are more important to this watershed, or it's really critical that we preserve things in this headwaters area. But I think we're all seeing where, just to avoid the whole regulatory process, people avoid impacting a little 2-acre wetland that in the big picture of this watershed is really kind of disposable at this point, and its functions might be better off put into a bank or some larger scale restoration. Of course, the trick with that is doing that in a way that doesn't get other unintended consequences from consultants. Same thing with in-kind. Really, the thrust in the whole program now is to require in-kind mitigation. Oftentimes, that's not really done. I think a lot of us, as a practical matter, look for in-kind or better. A lot of times, what's being impacted, you really don't need more of that. You need what it used to be, right? But again, these watershed plans may be saying, in this watershed, what's really critical is this kind of wetland, a riparian wetland or something like that. And so we need the flexibility to direct other kinds of mitigation to that. So it would be technically out of kind, but consistent with the plan. And then I guess this, I had to reread that. I couldn't remember what I said. it has to do with just the workload. I think we maybe just touched on it briefly yesterday that somehow this has to not come all back on us, the federal agencies, to be spoon-feeding them what to do for their mitigation. They need to read the plan, they need to do the homework, and then decide what part of what the plan said fits their mitigation needs. We don't want to be doing that much hand-holding and spoon-feeding them on all of that. So I think with that, we will go towards discussion and questions that you have.